It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It's been 50 years since the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. There is no doubt that Robert F. Kennedy has taken on mythic proportions, indeed the aspirations of a generation, with the eloquence of his words. He swept to victory in the California presidential primary and told his supporters that it was on to Chicago, the Democratic National Convention. But in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel that night in 1968, ended dreams of many in the tumultuous years. It was also a year that saw the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., the fevered pitch of the anti-war movement, and the election of Richard M. Nixon to the White House. Kennedy is quoted as saying once, "Some men see things as they are and ask why. I dream of things that never were and ask why not." In our studio this morning is Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at Salisbury University. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So what is your sense about that moment in time that you learned from, I don't know how old you were, but what sense
you
and what were you doing when you learned about it, if you remember it?
Let's see. That has to be when I was still in high school, actually, I believe. And I grew up in a Catholic family, and my father was dead for quite some time, but my mother was an ardent Kennedy fan, I must say, and so that we were struck, as we had been as a family. With my seven siblings, actually, with the death of course, President Kennedy previously, and then the second, essentially a kind of second blow, I think, was what my family felt. And my politics, of course, had not developed much at that point. So I wasn't politically, I was more naive, I think, in terms of what the politics were. But certainly as someone from a Catholic family, it was the aspirational character, I think, of Robert Kennedy was what struck us most, so it was quite a blow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I remember watching television at the time, and Kennedy left the podium, and they were sort of babbling along, as it were, and then it came back on, and suddenly there it was.
The vivid picture of Kennedy on the floor being cradled by a staff member was what's so riveting, I think, in terms of the imagery. I mean, that strikes me most when I think about it now.
So one of the things that strikes me is that if we look back at Kennedy, there seems to be two RFKs. There's the one before his brother was assassinated, one afterwards. And in fact, in the early years, he was tied to Joe McCarthy and the McCarthy hearings in the 1950s. I understand, by the way, that JFK actually opposed RFK being appointed as attorney general, but the old man said, no, you have to do this. What sense do you get about this sort of bipolar, as it were, a shift that seems to come with him?
I think it is striking because I think that we have to remember that Robert Kennedy had been, of course, a Cold Warrior, and he was involved with the disaster of the Bay of Pigs invasion and the like. But that I think as the Vietnam War emerged and raged on, and the Johnson period, and the tragedy of Lyndon Johnson himself moving towards embracing a larger war there, that Kennedy, I think, began to see the fault and the flaws in that strategy, and there was a change, I think, in his character and his thinking about what needed to be done with the Vietnam War. But additionally, I think he was clearly struck by the civil rights movement. I mean, I think one of the dynamics that we social scientists are always wrestling with is what's the relationship between social movements on the one hand and leadership on the other, and I'm of the persuasion that it's the social movements that drive leadership or generate certain kinds of leadership at certain periods of time. And I think the tragedy of Robert Kennedy is that there were possibilities that he clearly was emerging as an inspirational a leader. And there are some words I think we want to get to eventually to express that. And so that there were possibilities, and he began to see, but he was right. He emerged out of these movements, civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, even the environmentalist movement that were beginning to emerge as very powerful. And he was in part benefiting from that at that point in time.
Because, as a matter of fact, his comments, particularly as he was campaigning, have been described as for the minority community as a sort of bordering between Christ-like and celebrity. That is, he veered between preaching reconciliation, particularly racial reconciliation, but also then he switched to attacks on wealth and privilege and power, which of course is a certain irony in that, given the family that they came from.
Yeah, absolutely. If I may, one of the other pieces of this history, I think, that strikes me most is his oratory. And the particular passage I think that's most powerful, most poignant, is of course with the assassination of Martin Luther King, and which had the possibilities of course there were riots, of course, so he didn't stem all those, but his effort I think was striking when he said, and this is most striking in the context of what we have in a president today. I mean, the dramatic contrast. Here's what Kennedy said. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence or lawlessness, but love and wisdom and compassion toward one another and a feeling of justice towards those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black. And he went on further, and he said, we should dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and to make gentle the life of this world. I mean, the commentary there and the rhetoric there is so striking. The humanity, I think, and the inspirational character of bringing us together, again, in the striking contrast between a Robert Kennedy and a Donald Trump. We're lost in the wilderness today in comparison, I think, with these kinds of words.
Well, as a matter of fact, one of the interesting things is that at the time, Johnson, particularly in 1968, was seen as a very uncomplicated villain when it came to Vietnam. And yet, when we now look back, the things that are really noted about his efforts in the White House is economic equality, ending poverty, backing civil rights legislation, much the detriment of the Democratic Party in the South. Did we underappreciate Johnson? Was it just the war that seemed to divide us so?
I think that's the truth. Absolutely. Because it is, I mean, one of the ironies, I mean, in this respect, again, I think that we get a muddled view of matter when we think about Robert Kennedy somehow as opposing Johnson, that it was Robert Kennedy who was going to push forward on economic equality and the like. And again, that's the unknown question that we'll never get an answer to, of course, is that perhaps he would have. But he would have, if he would be doing that, he would have been carrying on the legacy of Lyndon Johnson, because it is Lyndon Johnson who brought us the war on poverty. It is Lyndon Johnson who soldiered through the 64 Civil Rights Act. It's Lyndon Johnson who accomplished the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which is perhaps the most critical piece of legislation in the political history of the last half of the 20th century for the United States. So I think that is absolutely the case. And it should also be added that when you inquire further as to even Robert Kennedy's view on Vietnam, he clearly wanted to try to get out eventually, but he was no George McGovern. McGovern was once asked, well, how do we get out of Vietnam? And he said, in ships. Right? So he was like, you load the troops off and you're out of there. Whereas Robert Kennedy, his position at the time of his death actually was, we needed to stop the corruption in South Vietnam and we needed to modernize further the South Vietnamese military. So Kennedy was not really the hero of the anti-war movement at that point. In fact, if you look at the polling at that point in time, the anti-war folks were still aligned with Gene McCarthy, and there was a lot of rancor towards Robert Kennedy, as as accusing him as being an opportunist, right, and perhaps destroying the possibility of opposing, pushing Johnson out of the race and the like.
So how do you compare the two men, Eugene McCarthy and Robert F. Kennedy? And I understand that Kennedy obviously hesitated. Of course, McCarthy actually had a much better showing than anyone expected. He was the sitting president in New Hampshire. He didn't beat Johnson, but he had a much better showing. How do you compare the two?
Kennedy was more ultimately the heavyweight in terms, I think, across the spectrum of policy issues. Whereas I think McCarthy, you know, was essentially a single issue candidate for the most part, that it was really the war that he was most focused on and trying to push on that issue primarily. So I think that in a one-to-one matchup, if that had taken place, I think we would have seen a greater depth of policy understanding and policy thinking with Robert Kennedy rather than with Gene McCarthy. Now, whether that would have led Kennedy to victory, I think, is really questionable, because even again at that point in time, Hubert Humphrey, who of course was the guy who finally gets the nomination for the Democrats, had the backing of most of the delegates going to the convention. Labor unions were largely in his camp. Now, whether that could have shifted, of course, that's one of the unknowables. But at least at that point in time, Kennedy was on fire. But whether that fire could have been put out in the further months, I think is quite possible.
Yeah, I think as a matter of fact, there were only 15 states that actually had primaries, that they were really beauty contests and really didn't choose the delegates.
Yes, that's right. And so it's much the it's almost apples and oranges in terms of comparing how the dynamic works in our present politics as opposed to the late 60s.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that if Kennedy had won the nomination, do you think he would have won the presidency? I mean, it was very close with Humphrey. I think it was Nixon was like 43.4% and Humphrey was 42.7%.
If we can assume, let's try it this way. Kennedy was developing into an inspirational orator and leader, and the possibility, could he have been more powerful than, say, Hubert Humphrey in terms of his ability to rally and to generate enthusiasm? And we again, in political science, we focus, as we talk about going into the midterms, the whole question is, are the Democrats going to be more enthusiastic, more fired up than the Republicans, right? And so intensity of interest, intensity and passion is an important factor. And the possibility, therefore, one can make the argument, a plausible argument, that if Kennedy had been able to get all over the hurdles of getting the nomination, it's possible, certainly, that he could have beaten Richard Nixon, given that the closeness of the election itself.
So one of the things that was clearly happening was there was a great cultural divide, an explosion, as it were, particularly during this period of time. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. One of the observations was made was that Kennedy did really well when it came to minority communities, Hispanics, African-American. On the other hand, when you look at the primary results, he didn't do so well with white working class voters, even though he did have an appeal to them. I mean, he was one of these candidates who seemed to be able to, at least on the surface, attract them all. I mean, do you think that he could have bridged that divide? Because at that point, you know, there were white folks, particularly in the suburbs, who was looking at what was going on in the cities in particular and saying, well, we don't want any of this.
Yes, yes.
I mean, I think about Chicago and housing and so on with Martin Luther King. I mean, King, I think, said something about how he had never seen such hatred in the South as he did in Chicago.
Yeah. Well, I think if any candidate could have, Kennedy had that potential, I think, because he I mean, many observers have said that there was part of the dynamic of his change, and he began to think more in terms of the question of economic inequality, wealth and income inequality. That began, as you may remember as well, that Martin Luther King, of course, began to turn to that question as well.
Right.
I mean, King was moving, of course, in the anti-war movement as war was beginning to think more along those lines, but also the economic question was becoming more prominent even at that point in time.
Did People's March, I think, in
Washington? That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think Kennedy was moving in that direction as well. Again, I think it's a mistake to over-radicalize Robert Kennedy because I mean, some of his solutions were, you know, we need somewhat less government. We need less taxes on businesses to get businesses to get into the ghettos and so on. So they were more almost new Democrat, like Bill Clinton. So I think we don't want to misremember where he was at that point in time. But nonetheless, again, it was the times are dynamic. The pressures, the movement pressures on someone like Kennedy, if he had been able to catch fire and really begin and get the nomination, the possibility of him moving more leftward, I think, is there. I mean, again, it's his younger brother, right? Ted Kennedy becomes the liberal lion of the Senate later, and I don't think that's unexplainable. So Robert Kennedy perhaps could have moved in that direction. So as an attempt to win over white working class voters, I think there certainly were potential. There clearly was potential there.
As a matter of fact, talking about Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, what do you make of his picking up the legacy? I mean, obviously we have the Chappaquiddick thing, which I guess at one point, at least I think it hasn't been indicated that he recognized that, at least for the moment, his any aspirations in 72, for example, the presidency was gone. He eventually, of course, ran against Carter in 1980. How do you think he represents that legacy of the Kennedys in general, but also RFK in particular? I mean, he seemed very moved. I mean, when his at the funeral for his brother.
Well, the Catholic clan of the Kennedys, I think they were clearly a close-knit family, and perhaps unlike some families that break apart, diaspora almost. They clearly stuck together, and they were clearly public minded and politically minded, and they loved being in the public arena and dedicated to that. And I think that Ted Kennedy picked up the mantle there. It was almost a fundamental burden as well. I mean, his two of his brothers shot down in the public arena, and my sense is that he saw it almost as his familial obligation to carry forward their legacy and their promises. And again, as I said previously, I think the movements generate leadership, and the two previous Kennedys came out and were part of those movements. And I think Ted Kennedy saw that he had an opportunity to pick up the baton and help move forward civil rights legislation, environmental questions. But then, of course, the health care issue becomes – I mean, again, we have to remember that the health care issue was goes all the way back to Harry Truman.
That's right.
Yeah. And so that's always part in the background, certainly of the question of economic inequality. But also, I mean, Johnson, of course, with Medicare is quite important here. And I think Ted Kennedy saw an opportunity to carry forward on that. His relationship to his brother, to Bobby in particular, I think falls in the direction of with the oldest brother, Ted, John, dead, right? Then that was I think it was a strong bond between Bobby Kennedy and Ted Kennedy. And again, that I think was an additional, certainly additional blow, but additional obligatory duty from Ted Kennedy to carry on the political legacy of his brother.
So, I mean, especially when Barack Obama ran in 2008, and Ted Kennedy, as a matter of fact, backed him over Hillary Clinton. And one of the things that struck me was that there was this comparison to the Kennedys. That I think was an observation that had not seen anyone like that since certainly Jack, if not RFK. How do you compare those two? Because they were, I mean, both all of them seem to have some inspirational quality to them. At least that's the common denominator.
One of the things I think also has to be remembered about some of these particular figures is that they carry forward an ability that they're inspired to be in politics in the first place, but they're also quite ambitious too. So ambition is very, very important here. I mean, I think Barack Obama was always just striking about Obama's ascendancy is the brevity of his previous political career, right? So
right.
He was in the Illinois legislature for a while. He did community organizing, and then he gets catapulted into the public into the to national politics pretty quickly, and that's in part driven by ambition, but also a strong, powerful social movement that's propelling him as well. So I think that we see these kinds of figures, and I think we can easily predict that we're going to see this in the future too. These kinds of figures emerging as well. I can't put my finger on who that would be at presently.
right.
I don't know. Maybe Bernie Sanders is a kind of part of that. I don't know if he has quite the kind of mesmerizing quality as someone like Barack Obama or in this case Robert Kennedy.
So how do you compare the two periods? And are we living as a result? In some ways, I've always get this sense. We're living as a result of the battles that exploded in the 1960s that Robert F. Kennedy sort of oversaw during his time, that those conflicts are still with us, although they've morphed into a different fashion as we've seen, particularly and maybe become a bit more extreme in recent years because of the potential demographic change that's taking place.
I think that's absolutely true, and what I would suggest is that the legacy of the civil rights movement we can see in Black Lives Matter. The legacy of the women's movement we can see in hashtag Me Too, and that has generated. The Trump presidency with the Trump presidency represents Trumpism represents. Is of course the backlash, the reaction, the reactionary movement to these quite powerful movements that continue to propel our society. And again, I think the history of social movements is they tend to ebb and flow, they rise and crest, and are quite powerfully visible at certain points in time, and then perhaps recede and face defeats. I mean, I think. Clearly, the Trump presidency represents a defeat. That the social movements were insufficiently powerful to overcome Trumpism in the past election. But that doesn't mean they've gone away. Indeed, again, I think it's possible. If Democrats actually have some kind of a blue wave in the fall, that is going to be because. Of the civil rights movement and the women's movement, and those kinds of movements that are going to provide the enthusiasm for a turnout in the fall election.
We've been speaking with Professor Michael Laughlin, a political science professor at Salisbury University, talking about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy and its implications. I appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thanks so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. There are a host of Democrats now vying to unseat incumbent Republican Congressman Andy Harris. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Jesse Colvin is one of them. He's a fourth-generation Marylander and a former Army intelligence officer who saw four tours in Afghanistan. The Democrat says that his call to service began on 9/11. Colvin has also worked in the private sector, most recently with consultants Toffler Associates. And there's one thing that probably sets him apart from other candidates. He is a Democrat. But his spouse, Jordan, is a Republican. And Colvin is in our studios this morning. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Don. How are you? Thank you for having us back.
Okay. So you're going to be pitching yourself to a particular electorate, that is the Democratic Party.
Sure.
And there are progressives, there are, I guess, Hillary Clinton folks, more mainstream. Yeah. What kind of pitch are you making to this party, and where do you rate in terms of your politics, in terms of, say, Clinton Democrat as opposed to, say, a Sanders Democrat?
Sure. Yeah. I make the same pitch for regardless of the room I'm in, whether it's on the far left or the center or even on the right. This job, to win this election and to do this job effectively, is about building relationships, and it's about building relationships across gaps. It's going to be gaps in age or gender or race or in the form of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. Or to do this job effectively, you're going to have to speak agricultural and speak waterman and speak oyster farmer. So part of it is, you know, to win this election, I have to build and knit together a community that extends from the far left to the center to the disaffected right. Since we last were here, we were endorsed by Bernie Sanders chapter in Cecil County. Believe it or not, Senator Sanders actually won Cecil County over Secretary Clinton. All the way to this week, our big news that we were endorsed by former Congressman Wayne Gilchrist. And it's how does it work? We're all in this together. This is a referendum on Andy Harris. It is not left versus right or Democrats versus Republicans. This election is a referendum on Andy Harris. And our platform is really simple. We're sitting here in Salisbury, whether it's Salisbury or Wicomico County or the Lower Shore or the District, it's a fantastic place to raise a family. I bet you have neighbors who go back 4, 5, 6 generations here, and it draws people in. We have to give our kids a reason to stay, which is jobs of the future. And it means we have to address the urgent problems of right now, which is opioids and health care. Opioids, for example, is about the least partisan issue on the planet, because opioids don't care if you're a Republican, a Democrat, or independent. They just don't.
So let me just turn to something that you may very well have to vote on if indeed you get to the House of Representatives. That's impeachment.
Sure.
We've seen a great number of scandals when they just sort of seem to be coming out at every week. Would you vote to impeach the President of the United States?
I gotta win this office first, but yeah, we can go there. Listen, I served as an intelligence officer in the Army Rangers. Before I would cast any vote, I would want to see the intelligence or the facts. If you go to my website, it says the two questions I'm going to ask myself when any bill crosses my desk is, does it reflect the values of the folks in the district, and is it in the interest of the country? Without seeing it, I can't tell you how I vote, but I will tell you this. I would vote my conscience, not because I'm worried about reelection.
Are you concerned about it? I mean, you're concerned about the kind of things that are coming out of Washington, particularly by the president?
No, I mean, I am. This election is a referendum on Andy Harris, and we are talking about local solutions to local problems in our backyard. There are so many folks I encounter who spend a lot of time watching the talking heads screaming at each other on cable news. There's plenty of other people doing that. That's not what this is. What this is let's talk about what's best. How can we tackle the challenges in our backyards, and how can we give our kids a reason to stay?
So let's turn to some of the issues. Healthcare. You've said in your on your website that healthcare is a right. What did you mean by that, and how do you achieve that?
That's a great question. So I personally believe healthcare is a right, plain and simple. How do we achieve it? Well, in our district, we have 54,000 people who rely on the Affordable Care Act. Andy Harris, the incumbent, has tried to sweep it away with no backup plan at every turn. So step one is protecting those 54,000 people. Personally, I think we're all going to be on Medicare sooner rather than later and look in the rearview mirror and wonder what took so long. But the first step is just protecting those 54,000 people. Not for nothing. I mean, our district is unique. So you always hear, if you're talking about healthcare, you hear the words quality and affordable. Here, the third word has to be accessibility. We have, for example, in Kent County right now, if you want to have a baby, you can't do it in Kent County because we have consolidation happening in the hospital footprints. Accessibility is huge here. And related to that is the healthcare industry is the biggest employer in our district. It's 50,000 jobs. So if you sweep away the ACA like Harris is trying to do, with no backup plan, about 10% of those jobs go away too, which would be just a disaster for so many working families.
Do you favor any kind of single-payer system?
There's a plan right now from the Center for American Progress. It's a think tank in D.C., and it's a Medicare. The idea is to get, how do we get everybody on Medicare? Their idea is pretty simple. It's really three steps. You take Medicaid, bring it underneath the Medicare umbrella. You take CHIP, bring it underneath the Medicare umbrella, and then you allow private citizens or owners of small businesses to opt into Medicare. There are a lot of plans floating around that have a concept of how to expand Medicare so it eventually covers everybody. The one I just mentioned is the one that I support.
So, I mean, so you envision then that ultimately the country will be under some kind of single-payer system, or do you think there will be some kind of what you've sort of seem to describe for employers as a sort of a public option?
Yeah, it's, you know, the language has become very loaded. Single payer now means so many different things to so many different people. Step one is protecting those 54,000 people, and I think that the way to get to, if healthcare is the right, everybody needs to be covered, how do we get there? I think it's going to be a Medicare expansion plan. And then I try to avoid these labels because they mean so many different things to so many different people.
So in terms of taxes, you've talked about how you want the taxes to be fair. You said we must create a tax system designed not to help the richest, the well-heeled, and the winners of the financial genetic lottery. How do you do that? And since when people talk about cutting taxes, they like the idea, whether it's packaged with tax cuts that may very well benefit the wealthy, but nonetheless, it certainly sounds good. And how do you then do that in relationship to the budget deficit?
That's a great question. I mean, the first step is Andy Harris brought Speaker Ryan into our district to stump for the tax bill. If you look at how it was passed, if you care about accountability and you care about transparency, the way the tax bill was passed should get you really upset. It was written by lobbyists an hour off Capitol Hill, and then they brought it to the senators and gave them an hour to look at it, which nobody can read 1,000 pages in an hour. That's a travesty of accountability and transparency. We're going to need tax reform. It's going to have to be a new tax bill. And you're right. The breaks to the ultra-wealthy and to massive corporations on the backs of working families, I mean, we were told that the largest corporations were going to pour that money, invest that money back into their workforce. 433 of the Fortune 500 companies didn't do that. They used a stock buyback to take care of their stakeholders. So that's part of it. I mean, we have to do reform, transparent and accountability. You know, we have a career politician problem in Washington right now, and part of it, this is what happens when you have career politicians. You have bills written by lobbyists in the middle of the night, and senators get an hour to vote on it.
So would you be looking in at hiking then, and reversing, as it were, the tax breaks under this Republican bill that just got passed? And do you see yourself voting for taxes, an increase in taxes in some fashion along the line down the road?
So let's start from the beginning. We need to take the bill that just got passed and rip it up and start over. I'm very proud to be part of a wave of military veterans running for Congress this year. There's over 100 of us across the country. We're mostly on the left, but we're on both sides of the aisle. Those are folks who are sick of career politicians, and they're sick of politicians who care more about reelection than doing the right thing. It's sitting down and putting together a bill that helps working families and entices companies to come back and invest in this country and invest in their workers. It's not giving tax breaks to the ultra, ultra wealthy and massive corporations in the back of working families.
So do you envision, you talk about strengthening Medicare and Social Security and so on and so forth. Do you see any budget cuts to get your tax right, and then at the same time not with a lot of red ink?
You went exactly where I was hoping we could go for a second, because a week before Speaker Ryan said, hey, we're about to announce this tax bill, what we heard him say was Social Security will be protected and Medicare will be protected. And lo and behold, a week later, it's, hey, actually, now that this has passed, we looked at the numbers, turns out we need people to go to Congress and fight like hell to protect Social Security and Medicare. any tax reform cannot come at the expense of – these are not entitlements. When you go to the grocery store and you buy groceries, when you're checking out, nobody says here are the groceries you're entitled to. You've paid for them. I remember my first job at 15 going home and asking my mom and dad, who FICO? Who is Mr. FICO? I mean, this is we need representatives who are going to go to Washington and protect Social Security and protect Medicare, and any tax reform is not going to come at the expense of those two programs.
I want to turn to trade, which obviously has come up. The president, of course, ripped up the Trans-Pacific Partnership treaty agreement, and he's decided to try to do unilateral agreements, including the threat of tariffs that we've seen. Where are you in terms of trade, free trade, and the TPP?
I'm in the realm of common sense and leadership. I think rigid ideology is hurting us in our own backyard. So in the same week that we discover we're going to have a crab packing crisis because of hardline, rigid ideological decisions about immigration, is the same week that we reneged on the Iran deal, again, because of hardline, rigid ideological feelings about something that has the word Obama in the name and something related to how we want to have foreign affairs with Iran. We need common sense. If you're a soybean farmer in our district, and we have many, and you're looking at the prospect of a trade war with China, you have every reason to be upset. If you own a small business in the crab packing industry on the Eastern Shore, and you're looking at these immigration decisions, you have every reason to be upset, because this is what happens when you have career politicians who follow rigid, ideological, dogmatic, that's what they bring to every policy discussion, as opposed to common sense. It hurts us in our own backyard.
So were you in favor of the TPP?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a moot point at this point, given how the president agriculture is huge in our district. When they can access foreign markets, that's good.
Right.
Any candidate could sit here and tell you that he or she could pick any trade deal and point out all the flaws. I'm not going to pander or lie to you about it. I mean, it's the future of our trade is going to be agreements like this. We're going to have to get better each time. NAFTA certainly had flaws. TTP certainly had flaws. The answer can't be rip them up. We have to figure. I mean, if we can put into Congress people who lead with leadership and common sense and want to work together for the betterment of the people in their districts, you're going to get better results.
What is there, by the way, to immigration you mentioned a moment ago? I guess it was some tiff about what kind of wall you would build, if any. What's your position on immigration, whether or not there should be a path to legalization, and what about the wall?
Yeah, well, so I'm a family of immigrants. We came here in 1899, and we didn't speak English, and we came through the Port of Baltimore and been in Maryland ever since, and I think it's really easy to forget where you came from. So I bring that up to say I do my best not to forget that we were coming through a customs checkpoint not so long ago. You know, we need to protect dreamers. That's easy. Immigration here in our district is a little bit of a different conversation because it's talk to a farmer, talk to somebody who owns a crab packing industry, talk to somebody who relies on labor. They'll tell you, it's not how it's portrayed through Andy Harris's press releases. It's I know these guys and I know their families and they're good people chase the American dream. I was in a room where Senator Cardin got asked, well, we want to do everything to protect the dreamers. What about security at the border? And he said, listen, we need security at the border. It shouldn't be a militarized border. We should send that's not how we want to present ourselves at the border. But sure, of course we want a secure border. I'm an Army Ranger. I'm going to tell you something. I spent 4 deployments in Afghanistan with porous borders between Afghanistan and Pakistan. There are smart ways to secure a border, and there are ways that just don't work. And I know that from firsthand experience because our job was to track Taliban and al-Qaeda leaders transiting those borders. I spent a year inside the Department of Homeland Security as a consultant, and if you knew how the Department of Homeland Security actually counted the number of folks crossing the border each day, it would disappoint you a little bit. It's not a high-tech, video-based system. It's guys too often, two agents in a pickup truck going to count footprints in the sand, and that goes in a spreadsheet, and that goes to Washington. The first step to any bipartisan conversation on immigration is let's just figure out what's actually happening there, which means let's get some technology. We have it now to just get a better idea of the flow back and forth.
By the way, do you favor some kind of pathway of, say, for citizenship when it comes to those people, some 11 million is one estimate, who are undocumented in this country?
Any, I mean, the reason immigration has stalled for decades inside Congress is because, A, you have too many career politicians who refuse to sit down in a bipartisan way and figure it out. I mean, we were meeting with a group of police officers in our district, and they were self-described supporters of the president. And when it came to immigration, they said, listen, none of us signed up because we want to kick down doors all day and separate some 8-year-old girl from her family. We signed up because we care about our community. Where we get frustrated is when you have to respond for somebody who's undocumented for the 17th time. You got a DUI and I-95. That's a ton of paperwork, and that it's a pretty reasonable perspective. My point is, we need to sit down and have a bipartisan conversation with people who actually want to get this done and figure out what a pathway to look at. So, for example, on the Dreamer issue, we have to sit down and figure out what age we're going to decide counts to be a Dreamer. Is it 12? Is it 13? Is it 14? Is it 15? No, Congress has failed to do that. And then the other thing is, if we say it's 15, how can that person prove they've been here their entire life? Is it a report card from elementary school? Is it a doctor's checkup? Is it a receipt from Walmart? Congress hasn't done that. That's not incredibly flashy, and no one's going to – that doesn't make for a great soundbite, but that's what the actual hard work of Congress should look like. It's sitting down and having those really laborious but incredibly important conversations, and you emerge with, hey, this is a bipartisan bill that now we can define what a Dreamer is, and we can actually put a bill together that works.
I want to turn to the Bay. Everybody says that they're a strong supporter of cleaning up the Bay. You said that yourself. How do you balance restoration of the Bay with the demands of both agriculture and particularly the watermen? Oftentimes you hear even some of the farmers saying, we're not the problem, it's somebody else, the cities.
Yeah.
Watermen are not crazy about sanctuaries, for instance, for crabs and so on and so forth. What's the balance you strike in terms of the Bay and those interests?
For me, it's the Bay. It's also its rivers and its tributaries and the way of life associated with those two things. We are not a district of smokestacks. We are not a district of computer chips. We are a district. There are 535 people in Congress. If you ask me who needs to be the number one defender of the Bay and its rivers and tributaries and way of life, it has to be the representative from Maryland's First. We used to have that in Representative Wayne Gilchrist. He just endorsed us. He's a Republican, I'm a Democrat. We do not agree on everything. He's also a Marine and I'm a Ranger, so we have arguments about who's tougher. You know, if I'm in Cecil County, folks want to talk about the sediment situation at Conowingo Dam. If you come down to Salisbury, we're going to talk about chicken litter, just like you asked, and bunker fish, because that relates. The balance is, we landed on our platform as oysters. I want to get to 10 billion oysters by 2025. 10 billion oysters by 2025. That will force – it's a moonshot, and it will – you know, if you care about the environment related to the Bay, 10 billion oysters will do phenomenal things for the quality of the water in the Bay and submerged aquatic vegetation, all the things that make for a healthy ecosystem. If you care less about submerged aquatic vegetation but you care about the economy and the tourism economy and the jobs related, 10 billion oysters speaks to you. What's good for the environment, what's good for the economy are not mutually exclusive. So how do you do it? You say a couple of things. We are going to have to scale up these oyster farms to get to 10 billion. It's also building relationships in the waterman community, saying it's not that we just need you at the table. We need your leadership at the table because you have generations of experience. And it ties into education too. I mean, there's no reason we can't have a oyster farming major at Chesapeake College, at Warwick College. There could be research being done at SU. It already is being done. Horn Point and Cambridge should play a role. So the short answer is, how do we do it? We get the 10 billion oysters, and it's going to be great.
Turning to the environment, great debate about wind farms, particularly
sure.
Offshore.
Yeah, yeah.
Where are you? Everybody says that they're certainly supportive of clean energy. Where are you when it comes to the proposal for offshore wind off the coast of Ocean City?
So the particular one that's in the news, I don't. By the time I get to office, I think it'll be decided. So I really won't have a voice in that. I can tell you in general, part of our job. So when you talk about our jobs platform, it's jobs of the future. I talk about solar. There's no reason Warwick couldn't have a solar program. You come out in 2 years, you can sell a panel, fix a panel, install a panel. There's one county in our state right now where the community college has a solar program. It's Montgomery County. We need to bring that east. My son is 6 weeks old, and when you and I, when we drive down the street, we see electrical wires, transmission wires, and we don't see them because for us, they're just melted into the background because we're so used to seeing it. I think my son is going to feel the same way about panels and wind turbines. We are not a district of smokestacks, and we are not a district of computer chips. We are a district. We're the only district in the country with the Chesapeake Bay and the way of life. The future is going to be panels, and the future is going to be turbines, and the future is going to be oysters. I mean, that's how you build the jobs of the future here.
So if you were sitting there today, would you vote to approve those wind turbines off Ocean City? I mean, how much input are you looking at in terms of the local folks who are saying, "Hey, this is a problem"? Because that's a dynamic that's not only going to occur in Ocean City, but it's going to occur elsewhere. So that's why we sort of pressed the issue about where would you be if you had to vote on this? Because one proposal says, "No, we don't want it as close to Ocean City as the project folks say that they need it to be."
Sure.
Who are you listening to?
So one thing the military teaches you is if you want ground truth, you got to go to the ground, boots on the ground. So in oysters, for example, I've tried to seek out experts as best I can. It's the scientists at Horn Point. It's the watermen. It's the oyster farmers. I wanted to understand what would happen if a farm had a solar panel installation. So I went to a farmer and I spent a day with him on the farm. So you got to go to ground truth. So in general, showing up counts. Listening well counts even more. You got to go to the ground. So any particular proposal, it would be go down there and ask those questions. And in that particular case, it's going to be folks who are relying on the tourism industry, folks who are relying on certain hotels and their line of sight, and it's going to be the political leaders and the activist leaders and the environmental leaders. And this job comes with – it's not being done right now, but this job comes with the ability to wrap your arm around somebody, a group of people, bring them to a table and said, "This is an issue in our backyard. We have to figure this out. Let's do it together."
I want to turn to education.
Sure.
A lot of proposals on a national level for, say, free education for the first 2 years some kind of break in terms of student debt and tuition.
Yeah.
Some have proposed making college free.
Yeah.
Where are you in terms of the solution, in terms of the debt?
Yeah.
And how do you think that it's possible to have free education? At least for the student, anyway.
We need to be fighting like hell to make sure that we invest in our kids. That's possible, and that should be non-negotiable. What is happening inside the federal level, the Department of Education, under the leadership of Secretary DeVos, requires oversight, 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 oversight. I mean, it's chaos. Community college could be and ought to be free. We can do that. I mean, there's also a cultural piece to this. I'm a military veteran, and I get thanked for my service. It didn't used to be that way. Guys who were coming home from Vietnam certainly weren't thanked for their service. Teaching and education as a profession has gone the other direction. My high school AP history teacher, there was one of us went to cover American politics in the media. Another went to work in the Senate on the Judiciary Committee. A third is teaching history himself, and there's me. That's not an accident. That is the result of a fantastic teacher. He was in his 42nd year. We were his last class. And when we walked in, we knew we were lucky. We felt lucky to be in the presence of somebody who was such a great educator. It's just not like that today. And teachers are great. They're really good at always saying yes to everything, even to their own detriment. Can you take 3 extra kids with special needs in your class? Can you sign up for the next committee? Can you work with this? Right now, we know that we have a school system based for an economy that made sense in 1950. It does not make sense today. I talk a lot about rural broadband. Part of that is because we know right now our third graders, we don't know what jobs they're going to have, but we know that they need to get access to coding. And Queen Anne's right now has an hour a week if you talk to the people who had to get that, put that, they had to move six heavens and six earths to get there. It's bringing back culturally the idea that teaching and education is, should be venerated, and we should want our kids to aspire to that. And then it's understanding. The last thing is our teachers need help. They need 1 in 5 people in our district right now would be certifiable or diagnosable with some sort of mental health challenge. 1 in 10, it would be chronic. So in a school of 1,000 kids, 100 kids would need ongoing care for mental health challenges, and another 100 would need it on a rolling basis. Teachers need help, and they need help with, in terms of behavioral specialists and coding specialists and mental health specialists. It's going to take a village on this one.
I want to turn to foreign policy briefly. Sure. You were obviously in Afghanistan. What kind of principle do you think you would use in terms of intervention by the United States, and how long do you think we need to stay in Afghanistan?
Sure. Yeah.
down your alley here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so I studied Arabic in college, and my master's is in international affairs from Columbia. I've lived in Egypt. I deployed to Afghanistan 4 times. I spent a year near the demilitarized zone in Korea. Everywhere I've gone, I've gotten the man on the moon question, which is, you Americans put a man on the moon before there are computers. Why can't you fix the security situation in my neighborhood, or the plumbing in my neighborhood, or why can't you contain the regime in North Korea? Whether we want to or not, the global community looks to us for leadership, and we have to fill that role. If we don't, it will be filled. That void will be filled by Russia, by Iran, by China. I'm thinking about the Iran deal because it emboldens our ally. It emboldens the regime in Tehran. It antagonizes our allies. It damages our credibility. What as it relates to this conversation, we need Congress. We need people who actually understand international affairs and actually want to deal with foreign affairs. If you think about some of the people in Congress and the House of Representatives, you don't think about if you hear the word Paul Ryan, Speaker Ryan, you think about tax bill. You don't associate with him any sort of foreign policy. We need new blood in Congress who can actually work in the morning on a crab packing crisis in our own backyard, but then spend the afternoon working on something like the Iran deal. We need, and that's why I'm so excited about these veterans running, because all of us have been to far too many funerals in theater and come home and deal with. My wife runs a nonprofit to prevent military veteran suicide. It's post-traumatic stress, military sexual trauma. You want folks like us casting that vote because we're the last people who want a reckless war because we know the costs, the human costs. The short answer in Afghanistan is I walk around with a bracelet of a Ranger buddy who got killed in Afghanistan. I have every reason to tell you that we should get out tomorrow. If we leave tomorrow, there will be an attack hatched in Afghanistan somewhere in the United States or in one of our interests abroad. If we stay, there's no real good reason to stay, and we're going to continue to spend blood and treasure. The reality is it's going to be a multi-generational conflict. Anyone who tells you otherwise is lying or pandering to you, and we're just going to be there. And the one thing I think Washington has done a terrible job of is explaining, here's where we have troops around the world. This is what they're doing. This is why it's important they're there, and this is the cost you can expect to pay. It's absolutely absurd that we lost 4 service members in a country called Niger. And a senator on the key committee in Washington said, I didn't even know we had folks there. He should have been home telling people in their home district, and I will come home and tell people in our district, this is where your sons and daughters are deployed. Here's why they're there. How can I help you understand why they're there and what the cost is when they're coming home? We need people in Congress who care about this stuff and can talk about it credibly.
Finally, I got to ask you. So you're a Democrat. Your wife is a Republican.
Sure.
How does that work out?
Yeah,
and I understand that she worked for conservative Republican.
Our fights are mostly on things like probably in your home. Why didn't you take the trash out? Now right, the baby, it's why didn't you empty the diaper?
Nonpartisan, right?
I mean, we. My wife served as a police officer. I served in the military. We both firmly agree that if you're not going through something, you know somebody who is. And on the campaign trail, my Arabic's pretty rusty. My Spanish is pretty rusty, but I speak pretty good Republican because I had to learn it at home. So there we go.
So what do you give the odds in the minute or two we have left of a Democrat winning this seat, which was clearly gerrymandered for being more conservative than it was even when Wayne Gilchrist was there?
Yeah.
I mean, are we all just sort of blowing in the wind here, or is there something happening?
No, the time I can beat Annie Harris. The time is now. I'm the guy to do it. Why? When I first approached some of the powers that be, the National Party, and, you know, I said, I'm Jesse and I'm running against Annie Harris in Maryland. I said, first they put me on hold to find a map because they had just forgotten about us. And then they said the same thing. So this was a district gerrymander and a Democrat was never supposed to win. Part of it is working our tails off. I do 500 miles a week in our truck. I've been to the National Outdoor Show in Church Creek in Dorchester to eat muskrat because I wanted to learn what that was like. I've been to Ocean – in the last 2 weeks, to give you an example, I've been to 9 counties out of 12 in the district. You're just working hard. We raised more money than Andy Harris in our first quarter, and then all of a sudden it went from who is – there's no way, so maybe there's a chance. You know, we're building a lot of momentum. In the last month, some of our endorsements, I talked about I have to build this coalition from the far left to the center to the disaffected right. We have a Bernie Sanders chapter in Cecil County working for us. They endorsed us. We're incredibly honored and lucky to have them. The AFL-CIO endorsed us. That's Working Family and Labor. We have an organization called Vote Vets. Vote Vets is the biggest organization of politics for veterans. They represent over 500,000 families. It's a rough analogy, but it's like if you're a doctor running the American Medical Association, if they don't endorse you, that tells you something about their campaign. We've got a group called With Honor, which supports bipartisan. They bring in it's like Noah's Ark. They bring in a Democrat and a Republican, both veterans, and Congressman Gilchrist. That's how you do it. This is a referendum on Andy Harris. This is not about left versus right. This is not about Democrats and Republicans. This is about who can do a better job. We have a career politician problem in Washington, D.C. We have a guy like Andy Harris who's asleep at the wheel in the opioids crisis. Our fatalities in this district are 50% higher than the national average. He's beholden to his corporate donors from the pharmaceutical industry. That matters. It's just a referendum on him, and showing up counts, and listing well counts even more. And that's that coalition I'm talking about, that's how you do it. That's what it looks like.
We've been speaking with Jesse Colvin. He is, of course, running as a Democrat in the Democratic primary to unseat incumbent Republican Congress Andy Harris. And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you very much for having us again, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.